This is the Linksys from E2 podcast series with Gregor Ross and Andy Wallace. So, welcome to the Linksys from E2 podcast. Our guest today is Shona McCarthy, the outgoing CEO of the Edinburgh Fringe. Welcome, Shona.
Thank you, Andy. Good to be here.
I'm sort of pleased and proud to say that I've known you for around about 4.5 years. We were in a business group together, so I'm hoping today people can get to know you as well as I do and know what a fantastic person you are. Here with my co-founder, Gregor Ross, as well, joining me on the podcast.
Afternoon. And you're being very polite, both of you.
Thank you very much.
You know each other.
Wait till you get into the chat.
Yeah.
So really, the Linksys podcast is about getting to know successful people in whatever field they're in, understanding how they've gone about their business, if you like, in terms of their upbringing, where they've come from and how that's shaped who they are and, maybe driven them to where they are. And we're keen, Gregor and I, in Linksys, to understand, what fuels people. And it's, we're really interested to learn more about you today, Shona. So.
Well, it's a privilege.
I think the way we think about Linksys is what we're trying to do is work with good clients and good companies. And when we thought about the podcast, what we're trying to do, it's as simple as it's, again, having a great conversation with great people. And some of those we might know, and some it's a new introduction.
Well, it's a privilege to be asked, and you've caught me in my last week and a half at the Edinburgh Festival Fringe Society, so I'm feeling kind of relaxed and in reflective mode. I have one email in my inbox today, which is absolutely unheard of, so I'm going to take a good 2 hours to answer that one.
Good stuff.
And you went out in style, because last year, I think, was it the second biggest or first biggest in terms of numbers? You had 2.6 million tickets.
Yeah, well, back in 2019, pre-COVID, we were at 3.1, so that was kind of peak fringe. But in fairness, I think it felt slightly overwhelming for the city as well. So I'm really pleased that we've had this recovery post-COVID, and it feels like it's just about the right scale for the city to cope with now too. So,
and does it feel real that you're finishing up next week?
Yeah, I mean, I think this last week and a half, it's felt very real. Because you're saying farewell to people, and I'm gonna be very fat by the time I leave here, because the Scottish way seems to be to feed you before you go. So I've had a lot of kind of lovely lunches and dinners, and it's been special. But yeah, it feels quite real, and quite emotional actually.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. We'll keep going that way for the next few days.
Yeah.
But I think what we want to do is we're going to go back to start. So really, can you talk about your upbringing? So Northern Ireland?
Yeah, I mean, that's fairly kind of normal. Grew up in about 45 minutes outside of Belfast. Big family, big Irish family. There was 8 children, 4 boys, 4 girls. And I was lucky enough to be the second youngest, with one youngest brother. And I kind of felt that, growing up in a big family like that, and my parents were, my dad was a bricklayer, my mum had 8 of us to raise. So there wasn't a lot of money around or anything, but we were very well looked after. And I felt the elder ones in the family had to be kind of, fairly encouraged to go out and get a good job, get a good job in the civil service or a good job in the bank or become a teacher and the boys all went into the trades. So by the time it came to myself and Ronan, the kind of 2 wee gingers at the tail end of the family, there was a wee bit more scope to kind of indulge and support us to pursue the things that we were actually interested in or had shown some sort of aptitude for. So I got supported to go to university. I was the only one in the family at that point to go to university. Got really indulged in my interest in the arts, and Ronan became a pool player.
He was
the youngest. Yeah, he's world champion. Yeah.
Amazing.
Did you know that?
I didn't know that. So I'm seeing, I'm learning things about you today, Shona.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess the lesson for me
is, I knew you had a big family.
Yeah. And I think I'm kind of a real passionate believer in if you give young people the opportunity to pursue the thing they're actually passionate about or that they show some natural ability for and that is not a chore to them, that they want to get up and do every day. Yeah. that it's really fair to give them a chance to do that thing, because we spend so much of our lives working, that how much better is it to work every day, go out to work every day and do something you feel passionate about or you care about. And clearly Ronan's very passionate about pool.
Yeah, and you're passionate about arts. So I mean, what triggered that interest?
Yeah, it's funny. I thought you guys would ask me that question, and it's I suppose there's lots of ways to answer it, but I think sort of two things for me. One was the one kind of arty thing we did in school was school musicals. So you know, we did Joseph and we did Oklahoma and we did The Sound of Music, and it was one of those moments in what otherwise is a fairly turgid process. I think our whole schooling system is so geared towards exams and so geared towards, you know, STEM subjects, that the only kind of route for if you were creative or performative or was these school musicals. And I just remember them with such absolute fondness and joy, because they were the moment at which kind of teachers, pupils, you all became like a team. Do you know, everybody was there for this shared objective, and it was joyful and it was challenging and there was energy and excitement to it. So I really loved that. And I thought it was so educative, but in a less obvious way than kind of doing, you know, your times tables or.
Yeah. Did you have somebody that inspired you? Like,
yeah, I mean, two, three teachers in particular, two of them English teachers and one of them my art teacher. Mm-hmm. And they were just so, they were teachers who were so excited about the joy of what, you know, their own personal joy in their subject, that they were able to really impart that into their students. So if you showed an interest at all, they were just really supportive, enabling, encouraging, you know. So yeah. So there's that. And then the other side that kind of is a much more passive and reflective sort of side was I loved to paint and draw. And I always loved poetry. And in a household where you had 10 people living in a 3-bedroom house, I couldn't wait to get to my room at night, you know, and from sort of 12 o'clock at night to maybe 3 or 4 in the morning, I could get absolutely lost in a painting. Mm-hmm. And it was a moment of kind of silence in a house that was otherwise constantly people coming and going, constant noise. And I'd kind of show up the next day, either to my parents or to my teachers, with this work of art that I'd created. Mm-hmm. And there was always a kind of joyous response, you know. So I think it was that combination of the team side of the and the joy, and then this kind of quiet reflective thing to be able to draw or find some visual expression of something that had happened in your life.
And did you do performances for the family?
My sister's always, I mean, it's a big Irish family, like everybody has to have a song in them or some sort of...
We're going to ask you to do that later.
Not a chance. You definitely need a couple of bottles of wine and then you'll get a bad rendition of The Parting Glass or something. But we had one of those families where... my dad had a pub for 10 years, you know, and there was always a commodity of some kind. So everybody had to have a song in them or a, you know... something that they could do, you know, an old Irish ballad or story that they could read. And we still do that when we get together as a family, you know.
You mentioned you're coming on to sort of culture, I suppose, in terms of Northern Ireland. Do you think that helped shape who you are, you know, where you're from in terms of your...
Yeah, definitely. I think probably not always in a positive way. Yeah. I mean, growing up in Northern Ireland I was born in 1968. It was the year what we know as the Troubles started. And so those kind of formative years, you know, the first two decades, I was kind of so struck by how our parents had raised us to just be human and to not care who was from where or what religion they were or what nationality they were, but there was a determination in the society that I grew up in to box you in to one thing or another. I mean, I remember in my teens or late teens applying for a grant for something, and there was a box that asked you, were you Protestant, were you Catholic, were you British, were you Irish? And when you kind of ignored those boxes, there was another box that was, well, are you perceived Catholic or are you perceived Protestant? And it was just, you know, I always felt there was this determination to describe you in a way that was either to do with your religion, you know, the accident of the geography in which you were born or whatever. And so when I talk more seriously about what the arts has meant to me, for me, it was always a space where you didn't need to be any of those things. You know, if you went to see a band in the Errigal Bar in Belfast or in the Limelight or in Laveries, you were there because you wanted to see the band, and it didn't matter. You know, it didn't matter. Everybody who was in that bar was there because they wanted to see that band.
Yeah.
And I always felt that the arts were a place that could lift you out of that.
It sets you free rather than that restriction you're talking about.
Yeah.
Because I grew up in the... in Stranraer.
Yeah.
So I was very aware of the troubles. And my father, who worked in the ferries, would go over there, and there was times there was a huge amount going on. But you would speak to people, and they would talk about that thing you've mentioned, the restrictions, that feel of, can you be yourself? But it feels like you found yourself, especially through the arts.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. It was like a release for me. I mean Seamus Heaney, kind of the great... poet from Northern Ireland, he puts it much more eloquently than me. And I remember I didn't find out that he had described it in this way until I was doing Derry City of Culture project. So this was in my 40s, but it just meant so much to me. He you know, the way Northern or the island of Ireland is divided up into four distinct provinces: Ulster, Munster, Leinster, and Connacht. And Seamus Heaney talked about the fifth province that was outside the geographic boundaries of place, and it was the province of the imagination. And I just thought that was such a glorious idea, you know, that I could, you don't need to live in those parameters and definitions that others put on you. You can live in this fifth province of the imagination.
It's a great way of putting it, isn't it?
Yeah, and you mentioned that, you know, leading the Derry City of Culture, and then you wanted to do the Belfast one. That's all, you know, you're sort of advertising that city to the world, if you like, and it's and you know, taking these boundaries down, or barriers down, I should say.
Yeah, I mean, that's always been sort of so important to me. My very first job was running a children's film festival in Belfast, and I mean, what a perfect first job. And it came about entirely by accident. You know, I keep talking about it as like unrequited love, because I was working for a magazine on one floor in a building, and the Northern Ireland Film Council had set up on the ground floor. And there was a relationship between the man and woman who ran both, but it had broken up. And I always think she came and deliberately poached me. So it was an act of vengeance for unrequited love, in my view. although, in fairness, it could be, because I'd done a degree in film and media studies and stuff. I'm sure that helped as well, and it was pretty hard working. But running a children's film festival was a way for me. I kind of always felt we were so obsessed with our own issues. And to some extent, we're still guilty of that in Northern Ireland.
You've met a few Scottish people as well. We're similar on that one.
Yeah, I mean, and so doing this children's film festival. Well, first of all, when I went to university, you know, Paula, who's one of my dearest friends, is Nigerian. Mm-hmm. My first boyfriend was from Ghana. You know, I suddenly found myself exposed to food and to other cultural experiences that I really hadn't found so much at home. And then this children's film festival just felt like a way to bring the world to young people without them having to travel, without the need for them to travel. Mm-hmm. And honestly, we had films from Iceland, from India, and it was just, it was the joyous kind of way to spend my first 10 working years. It was very cool.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, your CV, you know, is before you've even come to the Fringe. I mean, we mentioned Derry and Belfast.
Yeah.
Were you successful with Derry, the bid, or Belfast?
I'll talk about Belfast first, because it sort of came after Cinemagic, the Children's Film Festival. And, I've always been very good at knowing when to leave something,
right.
You know? Mm-hmm. And I've kind of always left things not knowing what's next. And I suppose that does take a bit of appetite for risk and a bit of the universe will the universe will provide somehow. And so, you know, those 10 joyous years at Cinemagic, and honestly, like, there were, see, the people who came over to Belfast, and it was during the Troubles.
Mm-hmm.
And just to kind of give anybody who's listening a bit of a sense of that, you know, there were bomb scares every day. Yeah. You know, your working day would be interrupted by, and it's mad how blasé you become and how much that, how much you normalise something that's so abnormal. That we'd sit for ages, even though you'd hear the blares going off and it would be, you know, everybody out of the building. You go, oh, for God's sake, not this again. I've got this thing to finish.
Yes.
Do you know, and it became sort of second nature almost. And, you know, you go into shops like Littlewoods or Marks and Spencer's, and you could be searched. You'd have to have your bag searched. I mean, none of it was normal. It was a police state in many ways. But anyways, all these amazing people came to this children's film festival.
Yeah.
You know, we had Ralph Fiennes and Liam Neeson and Bob Hoskins, Helen Mirren, Roy Disney.
Now.
I mean, but it was, but I still look back on it and go, why the hell did we get these people?
They'd have said, and Shona McCarthy, that's what they would be saying.
It was really extraordinary. So then when I got this opportunity to head up Belfast BID to be European Capital of Culture, this was 1998, 1999. So it was, you know, Good Friday Agreement times, peace process times. And it was trying to engage a whole city in imagining what it could be over and beyond the Troubles. So getting people to kind of bypass all of that and look into the cultural DNA of the place and really try to decide, what is it to be from Belfast, and what does it mean, that, and what are the stories that we can tell that bypasses the kind of constant stories of the Troubles that others would tell about us, you know. And it was a phenomenal thing to be involved in. We didn't win. There was a bomb scare in front of the bus the day the jury came to look at Belfast.
Oh, my goodness.
But in terms of the process, oh, God, I'm so proud of the process. It was the first time that that I'd ever persuaded the governance of the city, and indeed the governance of Northern Ireland, to have confidence to allow me to put together a team that wasn't your normal suspects. So the team that put together the BID for Belfast was an architect, a guy who ran a digital media animation company, the woman who ran the Children's Arts Festival, Rita Duffy, a brilliant female artist from Northern Ireland, Martin Lynch, the playwright. You know, it was this collection of basically arty people. And you know what? Even though we didn't win, it created a cultural strategy for Belfast that I have watched over the years. You know, the Titanic, it was the first time we'd ever imagined a centre to commemorate the Titanic.
Yeah.
You know, because to have talked about that beforehand would have been, oh, but, you know, Harland and Wolff was the place that would only employ Protestants and Catholics couldn't work in there. And always everything was infused by this backstory or narrative of exclusion or difference or division. And yet there's the Titanic Centre now, kind of regularly voted as the most popular visitor attraction.
It's fantastic. So you feel like you won, even though you didn't win, really. I think that's what you...
But interestingly, and I mean, this is kind of, even in our pre-conversation, Gregor, you were talking about some of this stuff, how we talk about failure or how we articulate the notion of failure. So whenever then I got the Derry job, 10 years later, Derry, Londonderry won the first UK City of Culture title. Nobody had done it before. So, you know, in some ways this was kind of setting, you know, of such a precedent. But it was such a thrill for me, kind of, you know, to have got as far as the bidding process in Belfast. Somebody else won the bid for Derry, and then I get to go and deliver it. So it was like a journey full circle. But the very first interview I did in the Derry job, the interviewer, I will never forget this, her first question to me, this was BBC, her first question was, well, Shona, you failed in Belfast. What makes you think you're going to make a success of Derry? I remember thinking,
a little swear word might have come out.
Well, thankfully not on air. My mother would never forgive me.
No, this podcast.
We agreed that, Graham.
That's right.
But isn't it interesting? And I remember even then, and I was a lot younger than I am now, you know, having the courage to say, but what's your definition of failure? You know, show me, you know, somebody who's never failed, and I'll say that's somebody who's never tried. Also, I didn't see it as a failure. I saw it as something that I was seeing played out every day. But having said that, and we'll come back to it later, there's still unfinished business from back then.
I think you're proving them all that you've got absolute success. And I think certainly challenges in my life with business, you know, in terms of festivals as a business, that's one thing I've been watching your journey, if you like, and how do you commercialize a non-profit for the benefit of the festival itself? And you know, that's something I think you've done extremely well with, you know, and to support what, you know, the culture and the, you know, creativity that's there, that's often overlooked when grants and funding are around.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, you know, last week I was in Washington for various reasons, and it was the lead up to St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah.
So there's a huge emphasis on all things Irish America in that week. And I'm really struck by how Ireland, and by that I mean the south of Ireland, have really got this right.
Yeah.
They are so front-footed about their cultural richness, about the cultural identity of Ireland, that Micheál Martin the Taoiseach will weave seamlessly poetry through his delivery of a, you know, you know, huge kind of speech at a really important moment in the global context. And will speak so confidently and passionately, as does the President of Ireland, Michael D. Higgins, about, you know, Beckett and Yeats and the Cranberries and U2.
Yeah.
You know, it's so much part of the kind of the, it's so much part of what it is to be Irish is that the richness of our cultural.
And why not invest in that? It doesn't even have to be money, but I'm just saying you've got to invest in that.
Yeah, and when you go overseas, I mean, the thing, I have been so fortunate in all of the roles I've done that I have got to travel, even with the Children's Film Festival in Belfast. I mean, I was on the jury of an adult film festival in Iran. And when I was speaking to young women, you know, fully clad in their burqas and everything in Iran, once you got beyond the superficials of introduction and stuff, they wanted to talk to me about was, and they had read Patrick Kavanagh and you know, Samuel Beckett, and they were, what they were listening to was U2 and the Cranberries. And I'm like, and I've seen that everywhere I've gone, that people aren't, you know, on a human to human basis, they're not saying to me, well, how's the business of the fringe, you know. They're talking about the content, they're talking about the creative output. And so I think in terms of soft diplomacy, in terms of representation of a place and how it sits in a global context or in an international context, we to our peril, I think, underestimate the value of our writers and our musicians and our artists. So there's always a level of public subsidy or investment that's needed if you want to support your artists. But I've been fortunate in the fringe in particular. It's also an incredible driver for a return on investment into a city like Edinburgh, and indeed right across Scotland. You see the benefit of just the sheer scale of the fringe and the people who come and now know Edinburgh for its festivals.
So how did that actually happen? So you're in Ireland, and then it's 9 years, isn't it, you've been in the post here. So how did the opportunity come around?
It's funny, you know, because, there's so many things we could talk about today. I'm really kind of interested in how I'm finishing at the Fringe, because as a way to finish a job well, this is like textbook. It's been absolutely joyous. Whereas when I finished the job in Derry, it was awful. It was a really great example of how not to end something.
Awful, why?
It was awful because whenever I was lured to do the job, and it wasn't hard to lure me, I really wanted to do it. But it was with the promise that there would be the 3 years to deliver the City of Culture itself, but also the culture company that I was chief executive of would then run the legacy and would deliver on the legacy from the City of Culture.
Mm-hmm.
But a change in administration in the local authority decided that that was absolutely not what they wanted. And so the minute that we had delivered an extraordinary year, I mean, it was absolutely just still one of the things I'm most proud of in my career. And the local administration literally shut the company down, and fairly brutally, actually. They cut it down a week short of the 3 years, so that they would only have to give the team 2 years redundancy pay.
Is this the unfinished business you referred to?
No. The Belfast thing is the unfinished business. But I mean, as an example of how to end something badly and how to end something well, you know, the Derry job and the Edinburgh job are the two ends of the spectrum. So having ended the Derry job badly, I wanted to kind of go back to running my own company, doing consultancy. So I was doing that for 2 years, and it had taken me to Indonesia, to Jordan, to Hong Kong, all kinds of places looking at cultural regeneration in cities.
Enjoyed it?
Loved it. Absolutely loved it. And my girls were small and at school, so it kind of also suited me to be able to manage my own time.
Two girls, two daughters.
Two daughters, yeah. Tori and Dara.
Oh,
are they in the art? I'm asking you a leading question.
For my sins, Andy, yes. Yeah. The two girls are both practicing artists.
Yeah.
So the last thing they want to do is the sort of stuff I do. They want to be at the creative end of it. They want to be making the work. But I'll come back to them. I spent those 2 years doing consultancy after the City of Culture, and I wasn't looking for a big job. I wasn't looking for anything, actually. And in the first week in December, I got an email from a friend saying, did you see the Edinburgh Fringe? You're looking for a new chief executive for the Fringe Society. And I was like, oh, no. So I had to put the blinkers up. And then I got a second email from another friend saying, did you see the Edinburgh Fringe? And again, I was like, oh, no, I can't look at this. And then the third one came from the Fringe Society itself, from their outgoing chief executive, saying, look, you know, a few people have mentioned that we should reach out to you and encourage you to think about this job. And when you get the third one, it's like, okay, I can't ignore this. But also, it's the only thing, it's the only festival that I would have been interested in.
Yeah.
And it's not about being a big festival, it's about what the Fringe does and what it stands for. And for me, kind of having had to manufacture a whole program of work in Derry that was about inclusion and about trying to get everybody involved, here you have a festival that has been growing in Edinburgh for like 70 years before I came along, thanks very much, and that's totally rooted in anybody can have a go. If you can find a venue to host you and you've got a creative idea, you can be part of the Edinburgh
That's
Fringe.
That's how it started, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was theatre companies turning up and just deciding to go for it.
Yeah, I mean, you probably know that backstory, Andy, that it was the Edinburgh International Festival was established first as a this kind of grand gesture to reconnect people after the horrors of the Second World War. It's worth me telling you this story quickly because it's a great story.
Yeah.
So the Edinburgh International Festival was set up largely actually by UK government and the British Council at the time. We're looking for a city somewhere in these islands that could host this festival that would reconnect people and would be a source of joy and inspiration. And they chose Edinburgh in the end for three reasons. One, it was the least bombed city in the UK after the Second World War. Two, it was the one that looked most grand, like Salzburg or Vienna or some of those big European cultural cities. But the third one is my favourite. They needed somewhere that could put up some money. And obviously after the war, there wasn't a lot of money around. But the Lord Provost of Edinburgh's wife had won 10 grand on a horse race.
Oh, I don't know that.
So it's the ill-begotten gains of betting.
£10 in 1947, that's it. It's decent money.
That was the down payment for the first Edinburgh International Festival. But the guy, the first curator of that festival was an Austrian composer called Rudolf Bing. And he was a brilliant man, but his view of the arts was very much rooted in that kind of classical music, opera, ballet. And so when 8 local companies, 6 from Scotland and 2 from England, rocked up with what he would have seen as their sort of amateur productions, it just didn't fit with his vision of what a grand European art festival would look like. So they were duly rejected, and decided that they would find venues and put on the show anyway. So in a way, the genesis of the Fringe was a kind of act of defiance, a sort of demand for inclusion.
Yes.
And that sort of fundamental principle, you'll know our mantra is to give anyone a stage and everyone a seat.
So there's hope for us yet, Gregor.
Oh, yeah, you too.
That ethos is still there. That's nice, isn't it, to think that that started in 47 and through your time and all those years is still one of the key.
And we used the opportunity of COVID to do a kind of fairly wide-ranging consultation across residents and community groups and venues and artists to kind of see what it was after all these years that people still held dear about the Fringe. Because as I said to you earlier, 2019 was a bit fractious. It was the one time where I felt that the Fringe was at its biggest. We'd sold 3.1 million tickets. And you would have thought that was a source for kind of great joy and celebration. But actually, every interview I did that year, it was about, what about housing in Edinburgh? What about climate change? What about your carbon footprint? What about over-tourism? Do you know?
That's the Celtic way, isn't it?
You're right, because it's a bit like you were talking about earlier on about the island and Irish and sometimes being quite insular. And I think Scotland can be like that at sometimes as well, that instead of celebrating things and talking about how you make everything better, you have this success in one hand, but all this negativity in another. So you're sitting there internally, all this success, and like I said, externally, all this criticism.
Yeah, I remember that year being particularly tough. I mean, people always ask me about, you know, the COVID, you know, and how tough COVID was, which it was. But actually, 2019 was in a way more so, just in a different way. And it's because you think you're doing something really good and you think this is a huge success. And, you know, these people have come to the city, and not just that, but the creatives within the city have got this extraordinary platform to the world. And yet, everything that people were asking me that year felt negative and fractious. And I mean, it's interesting. And you're right in that a more constructive response to that, if it felt like the city was a bit overwhelmed by the Fringe, would have been, let's come together and talk about how we spread the benefit. Let's explore how we can come together around this extraordinary thing that we have. And any ways that it feels ill-fitting at the minute, let's address that and see if we can't kind of draw a 30-mile radius around the city and look at how transport links might take the benefit to this place or to that. But I felt there was a lack of imagination, if I'm honest, around how you address what is a very positive problem to have.
If you take it, the Fringe as an asset for Scotland, you know, I think, am I right in saying it brings in more than whiskey?
Oh, I don't know. I have no idea how much whiskey.
And in terms of an event, it's only second to the Olympic Games in terms of ticket sales.
After the Olympics and the FIFA World Cup, the Fringe is the biggest ticketed event. You knew what you were doing there, Andy. You touched on one of my sore points because, I mean, I've done a lot of reading about the impact of major sporting events. And when you look at the level of investment that goes into, I mean, the Olympics in London, $9.3 billion. And on a more local level here, the UCI Cycling Championships, $60 million. And it's all essentially based around the one broadcast moment. the big broadcast moment. And my contention is, look, every time I put on the radio, so many television programmes, I hear an artist or a creative talk about, well, I got my start at the Edinburgh Fringe. Mm-hmm. Even the flipping Simpsons last year had an episode of the Simpsons where Lisa's walking up the Royal Mile and goes, oh my God, the Fringe Festival's on, you know. Yeah, I mean, in terms of kind of seeping into popular culture and being part of a daily conversation from people on TV and radio, etc., the Fringe is just there all the time. It's undeniable. But how do you value a single broadcast moment over a sustained that's not just being a broadcast thing, but a sustained mention that has changed people's lives? And mm-hmm. That's before you even talk about at a local level the impact it has on local communities and local artists and creatives and stuff.
And all the all the support structure around that, in terms of the work to get the venues ready, electricians.
Absolutely, all joiners. All of that. I mean, and that's where I think, why is there this absolute disparity between a major cultural event, arts-based event, and a sporting event? I mean, it's when you're talking sport, your starting point is tens of millions. When you're talking about an arts festival, your starting point is begging for tens of thousands.
It doesn't seem right. Have you guys spoken about this before?
Yeah, well, no, it's certainly been part of maybe the business groups that we've been in discussion. Yeah. But I mean, it's something I'm, you know, even from my experience, taking my family to the Edinburgh Fringe, and my experience as a young person, it's something you always remember. And then as I've started to travel the world with business myself, you've just back from China and reading some up about the Fringe and your travels, you know, that it breaks down boundaries, cultures, yeah. Everything you just said a bit earlier. But it's, you know, what it's a fantastic asset for Scotland that they should be shouting about and investing in.
Yeah.
And I was pleased to hear that you got some funding from the Scottish Government finally, but it's, I would like to have seen another few zeros on that.
Absolutely. I mean, you know...
What was the funding, sorry?
So just recently, you'll have seen there was lots of kind of shouting about lack of support for the arts and Creative Scotland's multi-year funding had been halted, etc. But the Fringe never actually fitted within that anyway. So we fell out, you know, we fell between the cracks of all of the existing mechanisms, and it's only literally in the last week that Angus Robertson and his team have recognised that the Fringe did fall between the cracks. And so they have invested for the first time ever core funding into the Fringe Society in recognition of how it serves all of Scotland. And I'd say that's fantastic. And I'm so relieved. And it feels like, I feel so positive that I'm leaving on a note where the Fringe Society has put on solid foundations. But there is still such a huge amount to be addressed around the Fringe Festival and the infrastructure and support for it. And whilst I'm really celebratory, and I think there is a new footing that Scottish Government are on now in terms of recognition of the importance of the arts, I'd say I'm in my ninth year. I'm about to leave next week. It has taken that long to make the case. And that feels... That just feels like that feels exhausting.
Yeah, but you've done it for your successor, you know.
I hope so, but I will still carry on this conversation and try to encourage a deeper exploration of why is there so much value? And I do ask the question: is it a gender-based thing? You know, why is it so easy to support sport? Why is it so easy to invest in sport and for your starting point to be tens of millions? And why is it so hard to understand the importance of the arts?
And have you ever had a conversation with somebody and asked that question and got any sort of answer? Because it doesn't make sense to me.
No, I feel like, I feel we live in a fairly binary world at the minute. So when I say something like that, people interpret it as, oh, she's got a thing about sport or she doesn't like sport. And I'm like, don't be so ridiculous. You know, I grew up with four brothers. I totally see the value of sport.
As you were saying there about sport versus arts, endorphins, you know. Yeah. You get endorphins after you've maybe gone for a run. But when you've gone to see a good comedy show or a theatre, yeah. You come out feeling you know, your spirits are lifted, aren't they?
There's generally, that, but
it depends what you watch, I suppose.
There's but that,
you
but
do definitely feel.
Yeah, absolutely, fullness. You do. And apparently, whenever people sing together in a choir, yeah, their hearts also beat in rhythm. Did you absolutely know that?
It's amazing.
And the amount of people, really cool thing, because it's so diverse now. I mean, I think we looked at some of the numbers, and it was over 51,000 performances. It was over 3,700 shows.
Yeah.
And I think, well, it's adrenaline, endorphins, even if you go to something and you don't like it, the amount of people, certainly in our friendship group you speak to, they've still had a good day. They still, yeah, talk about the show. Might be in a different way from being entirely positive. And I think that's part of it as well. I don't know if that's a culture thing, but... Yeah. Whereas you, if you maybe go for a bad meal, it's a bad meal. If you maybe pay a lot and go to one show, it's a bad show if you've not enjoyed it. But the
fringe
in
that
way seems like an experience.
You're so right. We also, one of the things during my time here that I'm super proud of as well is we've developed partnerships with 34 different community groups to make sure that this festival is completely owned by Edinburgh's residents and it feels like it's their festival too, not just something that kind of lands on them. And one of the most beautiful letters we ever got was from a woman who's from elderly care. And she'd gone out with a group of others to see a show at the Fringe. And she wrote to us afterwards and she said, that's the worst thing I've ever seen in my life, but it's the best night I've had in 20
it's
years.
It's good, isn't it?
Do you know, because even if it's a show that has not been your favourite, to be with a group of other people where you can deconstruct that, where you can talk that, where you've got a collective, it's a bit like soap operas, you know.
Yeah.
You know, whenever it was only four channels on the TV and everybody came into school and you were all talking about EastEnders and what had happened the night before. I mean, that doesn't happen in the same way now, but there's all of those periphery benefits, you know, and again, to kind of take the sport analogy, yes, you get the endorphins from both, but I'd argue what sport doesn't do, the art does, is that really good art, when you've seen a play that has completely taken a subject and come at it through an entirely different lens, you're not just coming out there with your endorphins kind of wound up, you're coming out there going, I see that whole subject in a completely different light now, because somebody else's intellect and somebody else's creative brain has taken me on a journey to see something. And it's, I guess, in a way, growing up where I grew up and back to that thing of always being defined as one thing or another, you know, in my growing up experience, to suddenly have something that can come at things with a different prism or a different lens and come at old problems and challenges with a completely other perspective.
Yeah.
That's where the arts are.
Yeah. And so if you think about how you're feeling there and what you've just said, and I think we would agree, if you go back to 2019, so you're 3 years in the role, you've just had the biggest year ever, but like you said, you're suddenly getting all this external pressure. So in terms of the people that listen to this podcast and thinking about a leadership role, can you remember how you dealt with that at the time? So you've got this positive thing overall, but how did you deal with it yourself first, and then how do you deal with it with the team?
I think over the years, probably one of the skills I have learned is to not take things personally. So at first, whenever you're the person who's up there fronting something, and you're, and it's a very public job, this. So it's when journalists are asking you, and you know it's going to go into the media, and they're saying to you, you know, well, this is a disgrace. You know, what are you doing about the carbon footprint? Or, you know, what are you, you know, all these people who are looking for accommodation in Edinburgh, what impact do you think that has in housing for local people? And you're like, oh God, that's not me. I didn't mean to do that. And there's this inclination to take things personally. And I think one of the real kind of growing up skills that I've developed is this is not a personal thing. And everything, in all of these things, you've got to be dispassionate, deconstruct it a bit and go, what is the real issue here? And so we did two things in response to that 2019 negativity. One was to say, hold on, one of the things people are coming off with here is that, oh, this festival isn't for Edinburgh. It lands on Edinburgh, it takes out of Edinburgh, and then it heads off again. And we knew that was absolutely untrue. But you've got to then go out and find the evidence for that. So we did a massive data project looking at, okay, we have all of the data on where people come from and where is our ticket buying audience from. And so whenever we mapped out all of that data, lo and behold, the biggest percentage of our audience for the Fringe is from Edinburgh, and then from wider Scotland, then from the UK, and actually our overseas audience at that stage was only 8%. Mm-hmm. So really, I think it was like 58% of the audience was from Scotland. So not satisfied with that, then we took the Edinburgh data and mapped it out on the basis of postcodes. And lo and behold, who is least likely to come to the Fringe? Directly maps onto the areas of highest social deprivation in the city. Mm-hmm. And that's how then we identified the 32 partner groups that we would work with.
Right.
Was based on, okay, this is not good enough. If people from those areas are not coming to the festival, we need to understand why, and we need to break down the barriers for them. And so this initiative that we have for, it's called Fringe Days Out, is one of the initiatives we have. And it's a £60 voucher for a family and £12 for an individual to access the Fringe. And it's not one of those, this show is doing badly, so we better wallpaper the audience and give out free tickets. It's deliberately vouchers so that if you want to go see Nina Conti, go see Nina Conti, you know, that. And the community organisations called it a gift with dignity, because we also matched it with passes from Lothian buses. So there was no issue about, well, thanks very much for the ticket, but I can't afford the travel. And because we left the choice to them, and then did all these workshops and stuff about how to break down the Fringe programme, how to make a selection, because you were talking about the 3,700 shows. I mean, people can get selection paralysis, yep. Understandably.
Yeah. Comedy's still the big one, isn't it, I think?
I mean, interestingly, comedy and theatre are on a par. So nearly always about sort of 35-35, 35% comedy, 35% theatre. And then you get everything in between, dance, circus, spoken word, you know, people standing on their heads, street performance. There really is every possible.
I like, you've been there as well, when you come out of a show during the Fringe and you're next to people and you can tell they've either just gone to a show or they just came out and they're deciding where to go, and it's that interactive bit. And I think that's a real bit of magic dust around the event as well. So people come in for the day and they don't always have the day set in stone.
That's
which
like,
I think is nice,
right.
As a family, as an individual.
That's just poor planning, Gregor.
You could say that.
Yeah, it's a festival of discovery, Andy. It's
my wife definitely likes
discovery.
The plan, but I do like just the spontaneity of it. You know?
Yeah, it's the random choice. Yeah. Loads of people just go, ah, do you know what? Somebody's given me this flyer on the street. I'm just going to take a punt and go see this show. And that's definitely a way of doing it. But what I love is, right back to that thing about the Seamus Heaney and the Fifth Province, in many ways, the Fringe is the Fifth Province. Edinburgh is the Fifth Province during August, because people are here not because they're Scottish or not because they're Irish. They're here because they want to be part of this mad explosion of creativity that's happening in this city, not just with the Fringe, but with the Book Festival, the Art Festival, the International Festival, the Tattoo. I mean, it's just the whole city is just buzzing. And to see the conversations that happen between absolute strangers when they're standing in line for a show, or when they're in the Pleasance Courtyard, or, you know, watching a street performer, it just becomes this whole sort of community that are kind of smiling at each other in a strange way, because they know they're all here for a shared purpose.
In terms of the artists themselves, we've talked about who's attending. You gave some stats there from 2019, but there's worldwide artists here, isn't there? China, coming from all over. I mean, is that, have you seen that, you know, in the type of acts coming over here? And, you know, I think I read somewhere that you're saying it's the most well-known, it's the number one festival around the world, and the artists strive to come here. You know,
absolutely. And you've got, I mean, last year we had 63 countries represented on the stages of the Fringe.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's before you even talk about the arts industry who come here looking for shows to book, or, you know, the screen commissioners looking for new content for the very hungry screen industries now, and all those streaming platforms, etc. So 63 countries represented on the stages, and within that you'll have organised country showcases that are backed by their governments, and there's a selection panel or whatever to choose the work. So you've got a showcase from Taiwan, a showcase from China, South Korea, France, Quebec, Ireland has a showcase there. Northern Ireland, during my time here, very proud that they have their own showcase now too. So 17 country showcases there are, and so it's a real, and 10% of the programme is from the US.
Yeah.
So huge kind of.
And have you seen numbers change of people, like tourists come in, or is it?
Not necessarily the tourists so much, but certainly the internationalism of the acts on the stages is huge. And you'll see really interesting things in 2025-26 because it's going to be the year of UK-Brazil. So you're going to see increasingly work from South America as well, which is really exciting. There was a brilliant show from Mexico here last year. And I think the work that we've done in the Fringe Society to deepen that relationship with other countries, to make the experience really meaningful, and the scope for future collaborations and exchange, and the work we've done with local councils, with overseas ministries, with arts councils worldwide, to really provide stats and clarity around the value of the Fringe as a platform, wherever you're from. Because essentially it isn't just a festival, it's a performing arts marketplace that is entirely unique in the world.
So, getting back to you, Shona, I know the Fringe, in terms of, I mean, I've got a quote here from Phoebe Waller-Bridge, as described you as passionate, determined, ambitious, hilarious, and fiercely optimistic leader. So, over my 4 years, I met you when COVID was just, had struck. You said 2019 was a challenge. I know from being with you that it was a challenge. It was a challenge for every business.
Yeah.
You know, how did you use some of these characteristics to pull you through that?
It's such a great question, Andy, because, I mean, like, I found the irony of Phoebe saying that about me, because... and what a privilege. Like, she's the real deal. Extraordinary human being. But... You kind of need to find what your best cards are when something as awful as COVID happens. And with a festival like The Fringe, which is completely financed by the venues, the artists, the companies who take the risk to make it happen, because it's not a big curated, publicly funded festival, the downside to that is that when something like COVID hits, our entire income base is wiped out in one night. So alongside being sort of the first at the door to Scottish Government, who, to their credit, did give cultural recovery funds and also gave us, sadly, a loan that does have to be repaid. But it ensured that we did survive COVID. But you also have to kind of be really innovative about what else do we have in our toolbox here, or how, you know, how else can we get help? And that's when I really thought, we've always had the provision in our constitution to have an honorary president, but somehow or other it had never been a priority, or there hadn't been the same need. And the board of the Fringe Society also, when Phoebe's name came up, it was just a no-brainer. Everybody coalesced around, absolutely, this is the right person. And as soon as we asked her, the response was an immediate and affirmative yes. And since then, we've got Phoebe as our honorary president. We got Susie Eddie Izzard, who started as a street performer at the Fringe. Brian Cox, the amazing Scottish giant of a figure. And bringing in that alumni and those people who adore this festival because of the role it played in their own career trajectories and success stories. Phoebe put her money where her mouth is and put 50 grand from her flea bag funds into a pot that we matched to start a support fund for artists.
Because she performed that originally.
Fleabag. Yeah. Fleabag was in its first performance was in an underbelly wee venue down in the Cowgate with a tiny audience. And, you know, that's the joy of the Fringe when, you know, when you get a right Baby Reindeer last year, which interestingly Phoebe and her producer are now going to work on.
She's great.
Lovely
words. There was another great quote. Was it from the chair you mentioned? That'll bring us back to sport.
So this is in terms of your leaving party.
Benny Higgins, the arena.
Well, what Bobby, Shona's husband, and Benny are both Liverpool supporters. So when he stood up to give you a nice little speech, he basically gave the analogy of when Shona came in to sit down beside him, it was like Jurgen Klopp going into the board at Liverpool and telling him he was going to leave in a year. And
says it all.
Yeah, it says it all. And the love, there's the same love. What I felt in the room for you that night is the love and the gratification, unlike the Derry experience that everyone has for you in the room and what you've done. The other interesting thing you said that night was, since I've been here, you're going to correct me in the figure, was it 9 or 19 babies?
Oh, it's 19 babies.
19 babies.
It was 19. In the French society.
So you know, really sort of getting behind sort of women and the working women and the babies.
How mad is that though? You know, there hadn't been a pregnancy in the French society, and I mean, bearing in mind that this is an organisation that's, you know, going to be 80 years old soon. Yeah. And
just to qualify, it wasn't Shona's babies.
Oh, no, they weren't my babies. the most recent one just born last week. And, you know, just I think that's so important. I've seen so many people in the art sector, and it's, I suppose, the downside to what I was talking about earlier. If you do a job that you eat, live, sleep and breathe, and you're so passionate about that it is a 24/7 thing, for a lot of women, and indeed men, they can think, well, this job doesn't afford me the space to have a family, or having a family is somehow like a luxury or a, you know, derogation of duty or something. So I'm really proud of the fact that people have felt that we've created an organisational culture here where actually having a family, bringing your dog in, we're not finding solutions to cancer here. We're not sending people to the moon.
That's the importance of culture again, isn't it? Which is an easy thing to talk about, given what you just mentioned. That just shows some of the changes. And how are you feeling about the fact that you're leaving in a week, but the team are still going to be here? So how are they all with you leaving?
Yeah, I mean, I've been spending this week and next week doing one-to-one meetings with members of the team, because it is a big difference when you've been working with somebody for nearly a decade and there's going to be a change and new people coming in. But, you know, I kind of think a chief executive in this job has the luxury of coming into an organisation which is filled with people who know exactly what they're doing and who are so good at their jobs and so good at their, you know, and so the cyclical nature of the festival is they know what they need to do every year and there's a rhythm to it. So you've got the luxury of coming in and adding value, you know, and kind of taking the time to see where you can add value rather than micromanaging or trying to get into the weeds of what your team are doing, because honestly, they're really damn good. So hopefully the team will be able to get on with what they do, and Tony, who I'm sure is a great appointment,
he starts in April,
will come in and go, wow, isn't this amazing? You know, where can I add new value? And I've absolutely no doubt that he will. But I think that the two things from that night, that party, which I will never forget, the two things that really struck me was just the beauty of that artwork. I mean, if you did nothing else in your career, but somebody gave you a gift that said, women like you pave the way for women like me, I still get emotional when I ever say it, because it's such a cracking thing for you know, it's a cracking thing to be left with.
Yeah.
So there's that. And the other thing that I still can't believe, there were four people at that party who we've either had to manage out of a job or had to sack. Because you have to make those hard decisions sometimes, and But there's a way of doing that that is decent and that is human and that's fair. Mm-hmm. And that means that those people will show up to your farewell party.
Yeah.
I'm really proud of that.
That's maybe the best stamp you could get.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's certainly not common. Yeah. So I think that's maybe part of your legacy. Do you feel there's a legacy? Do you think if you go back to how you felt in 2016 and where you are now, is there something, maybe one key thing you've learned through the experience? Yourself or in the leadership role?
I've learned so much through the experience. This job probably more than any has really brought it home to me that the success of every single member of your team is your success. Do you know that you don't have to be the one out there doing everything. I think before there was probably, you know, that kind of slight arrogance of, well, if I don't do this myself, do you know, it's not going to be done right or whatever. And I don't know whether that's an age or an experience thing or whatever, or just how exceptional the team here are. But then I've always worked with great people. So I think it's probably about a shift in me that, you know, it doesn't have to be about, you know, people going, God, isn't she great? Or didn't she do a great job in that? It's, you know, knowing that how brilliant Lindsay is, or Chris or Jane or Susan Wesley, any of them, that them shining in what they do and being confident and clear and having a clear strategy, clear direction, and being supported with the right tools, training and information to be able to do their jobs well. Mm-hmm. That's my success. Yeah. You know?
There's a trust aspect to that, isn't there?
There's a trust aspect to it. There's a giving people the proper tools, do you know? Trust, respect, humanity, all of those things. So
treat others as you want to be, to be treated yourself. And that's the vibe I got from the party, just all the lovely words they were saying.
Yeah.
You know, and you've created that environment. And as you say, I think...
Shona, Andy was emotional after the party, never mind. You know, you mentioned quite a lot of it. And I think it's a very easy thing. We feel in business, or we're involved with quite a network of people because we're of a certain age, and get a huge strength from that. But I think as a leader or being part of a management team, it can very easy to feel by yourself or think you have to be above everything. And I think actually you get a huge strength if you trust the team.
Absolutely.
If you give them the tools and you're open to whether it's the fails or the successes.
Yeah.
And that's where you actually grow. And that sounds like the type of person you've been through your career and probably why a lot of these opportunities have come your way.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that assessment, Gregor. The only bit I would disagree with is I don't think I have been like that the whole way through my career. I think this is learned behaviour.
Sorry, it's learning from your experiences. You were talking about it earlier.
Definitely.
Failures and successes, you know.
I mean, kind of the last thought I'll leave you with, because there's wee phrases that stay with me that have been really important to me. And the Derry City of Culture job, I remember somebody gave me this mantra, a guy I'd met in Brussels, and I thought, oh, that is so beautiful. And I remember whenever I'd recruited my team in Derry and got everybody together, and I said, look, you know, our mantra is going to be, you can do great things if you don't care who gets the credit. And team were like, you know, they didn't quite know where I was coming from. And they didn't know where I was coming from because at that stage, we hadn't put the program together. We had no money. I mean, and we were already, a year had sort of essentially been wasted between winning the bid and actually starting to put the team together and deliver and everything. So we were already a year behind. And the whole, I mean, Derry was so cynical because it was a UK City of Culture title in a city that was largely a nationalist city. We'd had two pipe bombs put outside our offices in the first year of the job. It was crazy. And everybody was going, this is going to be shit. This is going to be absolutely disastrous. So me saying, our mantra is going to be, you can do great things if you don't care who gets the credit. Everybody was looking at me going, nobody wants the credit anyway. What are you on about?
Yeah.
See, the day the program came out, suddenly that day, everybody in Derry had a role in putting it together because it was so good. The program was so strong, so good. It spoke to everybody. There was no kind of bit of the bid that was for you know, nationalism, no bit that was for loyalty. It was just this, everything was woven in together, and it was really magical. And from that moment on, everybody wanted the credit. And for my team, it was just like, who cares? Yeah. Do you know, like, we can just get on with delivering this and be so proud that we're doing something that's really cool. But it also lifts a massive pressure off you.
Yeah.
Do you know, if you literally just go, that's not what floats my boat. Yeah. You know, who cares? Yeah. You know, it's actually the joy of seeing good things happen and seeing change happen in people's lives and their environments and stuff. If that's what floats your boat, then it's like, knock yourselves out, go stand up there, take, you know, say you did it. Yeah. I don't mind in the slightest. So that was really cool. And then the other thing, because Derry ended up so brutal, not everybody, I mean, Derry's a beautiful city and the citizens are just, it's a wonderful place. But there was just some bad behaviour in the kind of governance and leadership. And I remember a woman I have massive respect for, a woman called Aideen McGinley, actually. She was the first permanent secretary who was female in Northern Ireland. So she broke mm-hmm. all kinds of glass ceilings. Mm-hmm. One of those people way ahead of her time. And I remember being so cross at just bullying and bad behaviour and bad treatment. And I remember her saying, Shona, disarm with dignity. And I just, again, it's one of those wee phrases that has stayed with me. You know, you can either get in there and scrap and, you know, be forever in conflict resolution of some kind, or you can just hold on to the mantra of, you know, you can do great things if you don't care who gets the credit, and just disarm the situation with dignity. Yeah.
Can I just bring it to the silent support network, which we all have in business, which are family?
Yeah.
They're a great support network. I mean, now that you're coming to the end of this 9-year stint, what are you looking forward to doing with Bobby and with the girls?
Yeah, I'm going to spoil that man rotten. I mean, I told Bobby I would do this job for 5 years, and I'm here 9. And, you know, for clarity, he didn't move over to Edinburgh. So this has been largely a commute. So I cannot wait to just go back. I mean, we'll probably hate each other, you know.
he said during COVID was the best time because you actually were getting time to spend together.
Yeah, well, you know, during lockdown was the last time we had proper time kind of being in the same space together. And he makes me laugh every day. And he's just one of those absolute solid people that I wish everyone had in their lives, because he just keeps it steady.
What's the saying behind every sort of good woman leader, there's a strong man? is that the saying? But lovely girls, you know, I had the pleasure of meeting them, and they're into music, as my daughter is, and you know, you must be excited for them.
I'm excited for them, for their bravery, their creative bravery. You know, it's not easy to be an artist.
Yeah.
You know, you're guaranteed to be behind your entire peer group when it comes to being able to get your first house, or, you know, buy a car, or because you're kind of dependent largely on, you know, your gigs and your freelance and your, you know, 0 hours contracts, and you're always having to hold down 2 or 3 other jobs while supporting your creativity. And watching them stick it out and just how hard they work. And their growing talent, each of them. You know, Dara's a harpist and Tori is a DJ. Tori's based in London, Dara's based in Edinburgh. But also, and you'll know this because I've seen your lovely kids, Andy. They're just decent human beings.
Yeah.
Who I'm proud to see in a room with other people, because they're just kind and good
it's
people.
It's probably the most important aspect.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they told you, but they're very proud of you.
Do you know what they told me? They said, Mommy, if one more person comes up and tells us how cool you are.
I was that person, sorry.
That's back to the coach now, anyway.
That was very cute, actually. It was really lovely. And then I had to do this thing for St. Patrick. I chair a panel on the St. Patrick's celebrations at assembly rooms the other evening. Mm. And I'd just come back from Washington, so I hadn't seen Dara for ages. And Andrea was running through the running order of the evening. Mm. And she said to me, and then we'll have Dara back into play. And I said, you'll have who? And she said, oh, Dara Watson, she's playing tonight. I was like, that's my daughter. So that was a really lovely, you know, to go into a space where I was doing something, you know, in my role, and there was Dara playing her harp on the stage. And you get the mummy eyes on. And,
That's brilliant. So I think we've got one more question, but I know you said you wanted to circle back to, was it Belfast you want to go back to on some unfinished business? Do you want to mention that and then we'll go with the last question?
Well remembered, Gregor. People have been asking me since I announced my standing down from the Fringe Society. They've been asking me, you know, since October, what's next? What big festival are you moving on to? What big job is next? And I guess, you know, I was just so clear that I had no notion in my head of another big job. Certainly not another big festival. And so I got approaches about various things, all on a similar vein, you know, big, other, mega, all-consuming jobs. And every time I would phone Bobby and say, God, I'm being reached out to about this thing today. And after a wee while, after about 2 or 3 weeks, he said, you know, you keep telling me you're really clear about what you don't want to do, but what do you want to do? And it was a hard question to answer, actually, because I really wasn't clear. But just because he asked it to me, you know, the truth came out from somewhere. I said, you know what's weird, Bobby? I feel a real sense of unfinished business in Belfast. I feel like all of the stuff that we put in that Belfast bid back in 1999, so much of it has come to pass, except the hardest bit, the big core theme of it, which was to live without walls. Which was about not so much the physical barriers that are still in Belfast, but there are 20 miles of peace wall still in Belfast. And this is, you know, how long? 27 years after the signing of the Good Friday Agreement. But it's as much about moving the barriers between our communities and in people's heads. And I said, I don't know what it is, but I'd love to do something in that area or support people in some way. And he said, you're freaking mad. What on earth would you want to get involved in that for? And 2 weeks later, I got an email saying, we just wondered if you'd be interested in this. And it was, they were looking for new directors for the International Fund for Ireland. And I honestly couldn't believe it, because the International Fund for Ireland is the only body that has supported even the bringing down of the small bits of wall that have come down. And more importantly, it has supported grassroots community leaders to really address the hardest stuff at the coal faces of division still in Northern Ireland. So it just felt like I'd put something out into the universe and this thing had come back. And not only that, I put my application in pre-Christmas, and then on my birthday in January, I got a phone call to say, look, we'd really like you to be the chair. So that just I'm so excited to go back home, because I've never been driven by the next big job, or it's just not about being a big festival or a big job. It's about trying to pursue a route in life that means something to you, that you can put your efforts and passion into. So, going back to...
We wish you all the best with that. It's almost manifested itself for you again in the next step.
Hope so. And I mean, it's about supporting those amazing people who have already come so far and been doing so much, and just whatever value I can add in that space to help people to continue on a path to sustainable peace and working together in that wee place that I come from.
I'm sure all your experiences will just put you in absolute... right position to take that forward, you know. And
hope so. I'll go at it with commitment and care and
all
passion.
Phoebe's statements about you will come to the fore, I'm sure.
Oh, she's
so just one, finally, Shona, just I suppose as you're coming closing your chapter in the Fringe position, what's the one thing that you'll take from that you'll love the most? And I suppose on the flip side, what's one thing you won't be sad about leaving?
The thing that I'll miss about it most is Whenever you work in this little space on the Royal Mile, and we'll always keep the shop, even when the team moved to the lovely new space on Infirmary Street, the shop is iconic and will always be here. And there's a moment when you get to about, I think it's the last week of July, and before that it's all been the normal Edinburgh, and you kind of walk out every day and people are doing their normal things, and then you go out onto that high street and suddenly you have no idea what you're going to see. You could see a moving telephone box, you could see, you can see somebody dressed as a cat, you can see a group of South Korean performers on one platform, a load of kids on a stage that we've created on the Royal Mile for young people, local young people to be able to perform. It's just like this magical kind of transformation that's all about just people expressing themselves creatively in some way or other. And it's like magic. It's like kids coming down on Christmas morning.
Yeah.
I will really miss that because it just brings a smile to your face, you know. 200 people gathered around a street performer who's holding their attention for 45 minutes to an hour.
And 11 months for you guys preparing the presents to put the bottom of the tree, isn't it? I mean, there's a lot of hard work, isn't it?
Yeah, so it is properly like Christmas morning. Yeah. So I will miss that. What I won't miss is the all-consuming nature of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's been... On my way back from Washington, I started to read a book that Bobby had bought me. And I could not believe that I was on a plane journey where I wasn't sitting with my laptop. There just came a moment where I was like, my God, I can read a book. And that's not right, you know, that it feels like a luxury to have time to read a book.
Was that a good book?
It's Marion Keyes. I'm only halfway through, but it's really engaging to keep me with it.
We're flinging another question. Is there a book or an artist or somebody who would you recommend, or what do you enjoy reading?
I really love, this is going to sound very parochial after me going on about not being parochial. There's an Irish author called John McGahern whose writing is so much about small things. It's about my mum's community. It's about, you know, growing up in a rural part of Ireland where it's the small things and the small exchanges between people and the small kindnesses that really define community. He wrote a beautiful book called That They May Face the Rising Sun, and they've just made a movie of it as well. And I love his writing. And the other one, there's a book called A Prayer for Owen Meany, written by John Irving, that I just love that book as well. But as for a performing artist, impossible. It's about the show, it's about the story that they're telling in that year, but too many extraordinary fringe shows that have moved me, that have made me cry, that have made me laugh till I've fallen off my seat, just too many to mention. I guess I kind of urge anybody, find a way to do the fringe, you know, don't be intimidated by the scale of it. If it means just choosing a venue and going there and, you know, going to two or three shows in that one venue, that's a way to do it. Yeah. If it means choosing the one art form that particularly interests you, like I love gig theatre, you know, which is essentially theatre that's done through music, but it's not musical theatre. And I'll find that stuff in the programme and make sure I go see those shows. There's a way to do it. Don't let it's like going to TK Maxx to shop. Don't let the scale of it intimidate you. Yeah. Just find your way.
Well, I think that's quite a fitting end to you're promoting the fringe even as you're leaving it.
Oh, I'll be promoting it for the rest of my life.
It'll never stop. Yeah. Luke, thanks very much, Sean. You've been so kind with your time. It's been an absolute delight. And I'm thinking this should be part one. I think we're going to need a part two, if not a part three and four of the podcast. So it'd be great to have you back in a while. to see what's been next. Let me have a chance to go
walk the beach in Ballycastle.
And read a few books.
Hang out with Bobby.
We'll do it on the beach.
Read a few books. Do something else that's interesting before I come back and talk to you.
As I say, proud to have you as a friend, Shona, and thanks for sharing your time and spending time with Gregor and myself. Really appreciate it, and wish you all the best for the future.
Absolute pleasure, and good luck with your own ventures.
Thank you very much.
Cheers.